Session number 10885, reel 4.
Lillian Cadoux, reel 4. We could have been married in Cologne Cathedral, but I just didn't know anything at all about it. Another couple who had met at Mount Waltham and who also went abroad with French Relief Service did know, for the simple reason that they were working in a team in Cologne. FRS had one there, but FAU did not. So hence the way that we went ahead with our arrangements, but knowing all the time that when we came back to England, the marriage would be blessed by Harold's father.
Because you married into a very distinguished family, didn't you, Lillian?
Yes. Harold's father had never been an actual practicing minister of religion, that is, in charge of a church, but was a Congregationalist minister and theologian, and was at that time vice principal of Mansfield College, Oxford. And in fact, so ill already that if we had have had the wedding in England, he might have been too ill to attend it, any excitement perhaps being too much. So our consciences were quite clear about having this civil wedding in Germany. Do you want me to go on specifically now with the work in Germany? Yes. You asked me earlier whether I felt that my training had really prepared me for it, and of course I couldn't help thinking that was rather a joke, because I was qualified to boil up 300 gallons of soup in a field kitchen for displaced persons living in a refugee camp. I could have de-loused them. I could have built a very efficient shower bath made out of two old buckets and a length of string. But instead I arrived in this desperately bombed city to work in the Rathaus, which is their town hall.
What was the city called?
Bochum in the Ruhr. And of course it was the headquarters of the Krupps works. So naturally the RAF had done their best to bomb it out of existence, and the bombing was so bad that the FAU couldn't find accommodation for its team any nearer than a village about 18 kilometres away called Folmerstein, which had a very famous cripple home. So we had very strong links with the Evangelische Church, because we were very friendly with the couple who ran the cripple home. The minister in Folmerstein, wonderful, wonderful man, who was a chaplain to the deaf and dumb. So we had a sort of dual purpose, really, because we were working very hard all day in the Rathaus and going out to visit people in Bochum. And in the evenings, we had quite a strong social life in Folmerstein.
But what was the state of the people in that area at the time you arrived, which I think was in February, was it, 46?
Yes. Very, very poverty-stricken and shabby.
How about housing? You were saying the amount of, you know, destruction, you had to live so far out. How were they living, the people?
A lot of them were living in basements. You would drive along the street thinking that this was a completely blitzed area, as I was used to seeing in London. Nobody lives in this street. And then your driver, who knew the place better than you, would be saying, oh, no, we're going to call at one of those houses. You know, the people are still living in the basement. I suppose the majority of the people still resident in the town centre were living like that. But if you went a little bit further out, like, for instance, our interpreter, I can remember still having quite a decent house. But still the poverty, the shortage of food struck you very, very forcibly, because we'd been invited to coffee. And the coffee was absolutely horrible. Poisonous tasting. It was ground up acorns. And the people were so hospitable and generous. The Westphalian people, I believe, are racially indistinguishable from the Southern English. I think if somebody had been dropped by parachute in Westphalia and asked to say, you know, as long as they didn't hear the different language, where have you landed? They wouldn't know whether they were in Kent. It was orchard country, the blossom was the same. I can remember the beautiful lilac and cherry blossom. The shape of people's faces, the same hair colouring, very similar. And as I've just said, very hospitable and generous. So they had to give you biscuits, but the poor things didn't have any fat. So they had little gadgets, which one can nowadays buy in Britain, that press the biscuit out like a little pellet. And by that means, you can make a sort of acceptable-looking cookie. Very hard, tough, dry. A very interesting person whom we had to visit was dear Mrs. Byman, I think her name was. Rather like Christabel Bielenberg, she'd married a German and had got trapped over there. And her husband had died during the war, so she'd had a very, very hard time. Neighbours ostracising her. Again, as Christabel says in her book, the Germans didn't hate the English at the beginning of the war, but they were taught to hate them towards the end. And so Mrs. Byman not only suffered desperately because she didn't have access to all these little extras, these bits of black market goodies, the loneliness must have been absolutely appalling as well. People like her were entitled to instant Red Cross help. So in just the same way as the Red Cross had sent the parcels over to the POWs, they sent them over for these ex-Brits. And it was a very great joy to be the person who was delivering it. That was our function quite a lot, because we didn't go around in cars. We had huge ambulances. I often think it was a terrible waste of petrol, the way we used them, like cars, very frequently with only two of us in them. But still, that wasn't our fault. That's what we were allocated. Well, of course, there were occasions when we had a lot more heavy things and people to transport. So we had long chats with Mrs. Byman, and when she heard we just got married, bless her heart, she packed a small wooden box with things that were really her own souvenirs, you know, from early married days. Beautiful china, an absolutely unique plate, and things that meant really a very, very great deal to me. But of course, she was too old to come back. All her friends and relatives, I suppose, would have died off, and she didn't consider coming back to England. She'd be a woman, perhaps, in her late 60s at the time. Another very interesting but rather sad job, as it subsequently turned out, that we had to do. We were in close contact with both the Evangelische Church and the Catholics, and of course they hated each other's guts. We had to be careful to keep separate bits of information that one side had given us, and, you know, requests, most particularly requests, because if one thought that the other one had been given a sack of sugar for their orphanage babies, you know, and they hadn't, the fur would fly. And we acted as a sort of taxi ambulance service for both sides because they had no transport at all. And we were sent for to conduct a young couple and their very, very premature baby to a church to have the baby baptised. That baby still weighed about 3.5 pounds and it was still very cold weather. And having been a nurse, it just horrified me that I was conducting that child through the streets to a freezing cold church to be baptised. I'd much rather they hadn't. Maybe their particular religion said that it had to go to the church to be baptised. I can't remember which religion they were now.
Were you given any instructions about, you know, fraternising with the Germans when you went? Was it frowned on at all?
Not in any way. The FAU must have been given full clearance by the army long before we got there, because our work was largely directly with the people. So there were no restrictions of any kind put on us. If we wished to accept an invitation and go in our spare evening time to visit socially, of course, we could do so.
Did you actively seek reconciliation?
Oh, yes, that was the big object in going. At one time we were asked if we could help with feeding of the miners because their daily calorie ration was far too low for them to do such manual work. Well, it was very difficult, of course, for us anyway to get supplies for large numbers of people, but we felt we ought to investigate. And so we went along to talk to a Major Coleman who was in charge of that aspect of the occupying forces. And he was working in the Krupp's mansion. Now that was a very, to me, interesting experience. Some miles outside of Bochum, the army had requisitioned this great place, and Krupps had lived in such a grandiloquent style that he bought an enormous tapestry. Could it have been 50 feet long? All I can remember about it is that it hung from the ceiling of the top floor of this house down through the well of the staircase. It was the only place in which it could be hung in its entirety. And Major Coleman explained that he was very sorry indeed. He could not allow us actually to go down into the mine because it was not long after a terrible explosion had taken place in which English people were down there as well. Hundreds of people had been killed. So visits by foreign nationals had been forbidden, but we could go just inside the portals of the place and interview people in the canteen. And I remember being met by a very overweight cook. She hadn't particularly kept herself short. And she said something indignant to me about how badly off the people were for food. And I said to her very coldly, I hope you realise how the people of Belgium and Holland virtually, literally starved during the war. I wasn't always reconciling. I sometimes felt they had to, you know, be made to understand. Anyway, it was certainly a terribly thin soup. I remember seeing it. Mostly water. But I don't think we could do anything for them. What we could do was to feed the school children. That's what you always do, of course, in a relief situation. Keep the younger generation nourished. And I used to love doing that. It's done in a very extraordinary way, in that we collected supplies from wherever we could. And the American forces had given us a huge consignment of what were called Pacific Pacts. These had been got ready for a campaign in the Far East where they would have to live all day off the contents of what looked like an outsized sardine tin. And when you opened it, inside there were condensed rations for the whole of the day and lavatory paper and two cigarettes. So we employed a lot of Germans working in the basement of a Rathaus, unpacking these tins, removing the lavatory paper and cigarettes, and putting all of the food into a huge pile, and that was taken off to some communal kitchens to be made into a soup. And then we would load up our ambulances in that much the same way as the little vans are loaded up for Meals on Wheels now, and we would drive round to schools and stand in the playground and ladle it out into the children's own containers. And I can remember two very moving instances. Once, when a teacher greeted me with great delight and said, ah, I remember being fed by the Quakers after the last war. And I loved that feeling of continuity. And the other thing, when the teacher asked the children to sing as a little thank you for... I can't think of it now without wanting to weep. I don't know. I just don't know why children's singing. Just does so much. I think it's because it brings back our common humanity to us, probably. So again, one hopes those particular children remember something about the Quakers. And then, because Harold and I were one of the only few married couples, we felt it incumbent upon us to accept all the evening invitations. The mayor and various dignitaries would invite you to incredibly boring concerts. You know, after a full day's work, sitting on a very hard chair, through chamber music, you'd nearly fall off your chair with a combination of boredom and fatigue. But you had to do it, because there they were, holding out hand of friendship to the Quakers, and the younger unmarried ones, who didn't speak good German anyway, and Harold and I did, not surprisingly, didn't want to go. I remember a Sunday afternoon concert, which was in commemoration of some concentration camp victims. And a woman reciting a long poem which told about these shoes being left outside the gas ovens Kinderschuhe aus Lublin. And of course, we were always told that they hadn't known anything about concentration camps. During the war, and probably in Westphalia, they really didn't, because I don't think there were any there.
What was their attitude, you know, now that they did know? Did you gauge that, talking to them? What did they feel about the concentration camps?
We never discussed it. It was far too painful a subject. You couldn't. As far as you could go would be just to mention the fact that they were now being opened up and were known about. And then they would say, but we never knew, it was all kept from us. You couldn't say anything more, you couldn't make them feel guilty if indeed they'd not known anything, and probably they hadn't. I want to tell you about Bielefeld. For some reason I cannot now remember, we had to drive over a long, long way to visit this epileptic colony, which is near a little town called Bethel. And I think we spent a whole day there, and I was very impressed, and I felt I'd been privileged to meet the other sort of German quite definitely. It made me feel a lot better. I hadn't felt too happy before, what with this grossly fat cook and these people who said, oh, but we didn't know. And it was wonderful to see some of these epileptic children were pretty hopeless idiots. Of course, you often get multiple handicap. And they were so lovingly cared for by these evangelical nuns. And it was like a small village. There were some 30,000 people living there. They had their own bakery, post office, shop, everything. And we were told that at one time Hitler had decided that he was going to try and exterminate the mentally ill. And I don't quite know how it was done, but the medical staff simply refused to let the SS in through the gates. Although I have since been told that if you spoke with great authority and utter conviction, you could get away with it. I've heard other reminiscences that are very similar. People have told me them, personal stories of how their aged aunt, who was Baroness von somebody or other, and who wanted to get her goods out of Berlin, just told the SS. So I can, in fact, now understand a group of high officials and medical men and the nuns absolutely refusing and preserving the lives of those people. And so that was a really, really wonderful experience.
Did you meet German relief organisations, you know, members from the German relief organisations?
Oh, yes. We worked very closely in contact because the ethos of the FAU and FRS was we must never go naively into any situation and start giving supplies away. They knew that the wrong person might get hold of them and sell them for profit. So I sat through many a long and trying committee meeting with the representatives of the Evangelische Kirche and the Catholics and the civil authorities. Quite difficult. Although I always had an interpreter with me. Sorry, I thought it was my own necklace. Yes, we had this... We had to work through the German organisations and therefore sit in committee. But I did have a very nice German interpreter who spoke perfect English. One of the difficult things was, having understood what they'd said in German, I didn't want him to waste time translating that for me. And he always would. What I needed him for was to translate what I had to say in English. But however, I'm sure people find this difficulty with any interpreter abroad. And there were some strange differences of practice, like, for instance, going to a Catholic orphanage and seeing the truly shocking sight of emaciated babies with arms and legs like sticks. They were the abandoned children of the East German girls who'd been raped by the Russians. I found that terrible, a really tragic sight. And the nuns were anxious to feed them up and get them onto really good nourishment as quickly as possible. And they said, please, would we get them white sugar? Because brown sugar was all that was available to them. And they considered it was bad for babies. And as soon as I got back to this country and had my own baby, and in fact did have to bottle feed him, I was enjoined to use brown sugar because it was a lot healthier. But difference in training.
Do you think a lot of rape had occurred in Germany? You know, these babies sort of indicate, as you say, that it went on.
But did you get yes. any sort of... Oh, undoubtedly. This is a piece of information I came across years later, but never mind. This friend of mine was younger than I and, in fact, joined IVS and was German. Living in Berlin, and her mother actually told her sister and herself to leave. Things were that bad that a mother commanded her two young daughters to just flee across Germany. She didn't know who they would stay with, what they would do. They made their way to Belgium. It could have been exaggerated by hearsay. But that mother felt strongly enough anyway. And here were some of the babies. And we had also a very charming German interpreter who I think only worked with us in the office when we wanted to send out letters. And again, the contact has been kept up. She's been to visit an FAU man who lives a little bit north of here, near Kendal.
Did you have much to do with the Friends Relief Service, Lillian? No, you were now a member of the FAU, but I wonder...
Oh, yes, we were still, of course, friends with people who'd been on that training course with us.
Did you feel resentful about them, the Friends Relief Service? You know, I wonder how you reacted to that ticking off you.
I felt extremely resentful about not having been considered good enough. I see their point, of course, nowadays. How very repugnant it must have been for them to think of somebody wearing Quaker grey and lipstick and smoking. I entirely understand now, but it was an utter rejection of me as a person that I felt at the time.